have an AA meeting. My name is Stephanie, and I'm an alcoholic. Welcome to the Monday night Blue Chip Speakers meeting at the NABA Club, where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more of sobriety tells his or her story. This reading is based on a passage from page 29 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual in our personal stories describes in their own language and from their own point of view the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and a clear-cut idea of what has happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on AABlueChipSpeakers.org, desperately in need, will hear our speaker, and we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too, I must have this thing. Now I'm going to introduce the speaker, David, so everybody give him a round of applause, and I'm really excited to hear what he has to say.
Well, good evening. My name is David. I'm an alcoholic. I want to thank you guys for inviting me, and it's kind of interesting how I got here. It was at the Roundup, and I was kind of browsing around the brownies and the cookies, and I was doing everything I could to avoid them, but I saw this very friendly face, and she introduced herself. Her name was Lisa, and you know, like all of us can do, we knew our backgrounds in about 30 seconds, and she said, hey, you know, where's your home group? And I said, well, it's 8111 Roswell Road. And she said, well, would you like to be a speaker? I said, well, sure, where? And she said, well, at NABA. And I said, well, I'm not sure where that is. And she looked astounded, and I probably should have known, basically, as long as I've kind of been around here. But anyhow, I'm really glad that I was invited here tonight. And I was going to start off with something, and it's that I do this in a always say a little prayer before I have an opportunity to speak, because I want to make it very clear that hopefully the message that I'm delivering will be acceptable to God and that it will be of some help to everybody here. And it certainly is it's a very big help to me to be here among people who are as close to me as probably any of my family. And I only know some of you vaguely, but I think we all know each other, and that's what's important. I had a very difficult event occur on September 21st, and I thought that it might change some of the text or the way that I was going to talk to you guys tonight, but actually it didn't, and I'll tell you why. My brother passed away. He was up at Duke Medical, and he had very serious heart disease, and he had finally gotten on the transplant list. And the transplant actually went well, but he did not regain consciousness, and he passed away. And what is so important about that, unlike some of my other careers at funerals and in times of need, the thought of drinking didn't even enter my mind. And I say that to you because that's kind of like the old cash register honesty. What it really means is I behaved like an adult. I mean, who else but us would say, you know, gee whiz, I didn't feel necessary to take a drink. You know, I mean, but that actually kind of came into my mind. Whereas most people would say, well, you know, you were helping your family, you're grieving over your brother, and you know, I'm not so sure that you should be bragging about something that most adults do. But what sustained me through this difficult time was very fortunately, I feel like I do have a good program. And I do have a set of tools that were given to me by God, it's my belief, to keep me sober today and hopefully, you know, for the remainder of my life. And that's why I'm so grateful to be here among you folks tonight. I do see some familiar faces, and that's always a good thing. And I actually would like to start coming here. I think that since I'm already into Lisa for some money, then I definitely will at least be back a couple of times. And she has my text. You know, I was going to say one thing. This is a serious meeting, but I think we also sometimes have to find some humor in things that I think only us could find humor in. But I was thinking about, you know, appearances are not all that they seem to be sometimes. But I can recall back a few years ago, and we have same format as you guys do, but 545 meeting is the one that I go to. So I pulled up, and it was my usual place. You know how we all have our own parking places, and you back in just a certain way. And I was looking at this guy, and he was standing out, and he looked like he was like kind of typecast from a 1940s AA movies. This kind of old, crusty white guy with this big white mustache, and he was out there waving his arms and smoking and pointing to people and all. And I thought, this guy's probably knows Bill W. And but I'd never seen him before. So we go in the meeting, and like what we do is a lot of times we'll have somebody that's kind of new that may chair in order to kind of give them some exposure. So this guy goes in and sits down, and then this young person comes up and sits down, and he goes, tonight we're going to have a really great meeting. We've got Ken. I'm sure he's got a lot to say. I just met Ken, but we're looking forward to what Ken's got to say. So Ken kind of scowls at the group and he goes, my ego's not my amigo, and he just ran it on. And I wanted to stand up and applaud because he never talked anything but just these slogans and all. And he would kind of berate people that would share, and he was scowling at everybody. And and I was like, God, this guy's really got something to hold on to. And so at the end of the meeting, the youngster, and youngster's anybody younger than me, he gets up and he says, Bobby is going to give out the chips. And Bobby comes over, anybody want to get a white chip? And Ken gets up, I'll get one of those. And he walks over and gets a white chip and sits down. He says, I just love AA, but I love drinking too. And I thought, well, hopefully I will not, I won't mislead you that way. But my sobriety date is February 3rd of 2006. And it is by the grace of God that I am here among you guys. It really is. And I've always said if I got what I deserved, it would have been some terrible consequences. And fortunately, I'm here among you today, and I'm full of a lot of gratitude, just the fact that I am here. But I was born in Atlanta, and I had a good upbringing. I had a good family. My dad was an attorney. My mom, stayed home, raised the kids. So I had a lot of advantages. I really did. And I don't recall there being, anything particularly that I would call damaging that occurred to me. And so in that regard, I'm fortunate. I do remember, though, because now I'm 66, so my parents were of that generation. They'd lived through the Depression. My father had been in the Navy in the Second World War. So, drinking was kind of a rite of passage that everybody drank. Everybody that I was ever around, any event that I was with my parents, there was always alcohol involved. And so I became very accustomed to it. Unfortunately, both of my parents suffered from this disease. And this disease did take my mother when she was 71. And so it does, I guess you'd say, run in the family. I spent an inordinate amount of time early on trying to figure out, was it genetic? Was it a disease? Was it something that happened to me? And after a while, I determined that I was spending an inordinate amount of time on something that I just needed to accept, which was that I'm an alcoholic. There's no question about that. I have no denial about it. I exhibit every characteristic and then some. But I was exposed to alcohol early on, and I can remember my dad would cook on the grill, and he'd be cooking a steak or something, and he had these frosted mugs, or these brown frosted mugs, and this is back in the day, you didn't have pop-tops, it's the old days, so he'd have these cans of Schlitz, it wasn't malt liquor, it was just the regular Schlitz, and he also had Carling Black Label, just really good beers. But he would pop, he'd crush it, and then he'd pour it, and you could hear it gurgling in there. And I'd be standing there, and, Daddy, can I have a sip, And, oh, yeah, you can have one. And there was something about it, it dawned on me. I was kind of romanticizing the drink. The whole ritual that he went through was something I thought, I think I could enjoy doing that myself. And, of course, I did. But that was a few years later, but not actually a lot later. But, you know, some of the things that I did notice as I was growing up, and I'm talking, this is kind of before I started drinking. And you know how we do say, and I believe there's a lot to this, that alcohol is but a symptom of much deeper problems that we have. And as I say, when I'm speaking to you guys, this is just me. So I'm not making any value judgment on whether you do or do not experience this. Something tells me that hopefully throughout this talk there will be at least some thread of similarity. But I know that I was, I felt different from other kids in the sense that I was shy and probably somewhat introverted, and I had not yet determined that alcohol would immediately change introversion to extroversion. And I remember one of the worst childhood memories that I had came back up. But, I was just kind of, I thought I was a regular kid. And I remember in kindergarten, there was this Miss Flint who, ended up being a nemesis of mine. She talked to my mother after one of the, this is kindergarten, for God's sakes. And she said, well, I'm a little bit worried about David. You know, he doesn't seem to be, he's nice, he gets along with the kids, but doesn't seem to, like, really want to be playing with the other kids too much. He sort of wants to just go off in his own world. Well, so the solution to that was, and we used to call it, with my children, a play date, but you didn't call it then back then. Ricky Landrum was going to be invited to come over and play with me. He was going to be a friend, which I didn't want, and I didn't like him. And I had like all old soldiers and stuff stacked up, and I mean, he came in, and I even remember what he had on. Like back then, kids wore these Roy Rogers, like he had like little pistols on and shit. And so it's like one of the worst. It really shattered. Now you know what I was talking. Did I have a bad experience? That one really, really got next to me. And honestly, I followed Ricky. Ricky went to Druid Hills High School, where I went, and he dropped out. And then I did hear they found Ricky floating with a bullet in the back of his head in the Chattahoochee. I didn't have anything to do with that, but I think he set the pattern early with tearing up other kids' toys when he was invited over to play. But I was the kind of kid that I was a good student, and y'all have to excuse me. I had some knee surgery, so I'm kind of leaning here. I was a good student. I had a good family. I had an older brother who I just mentioned. I had a younger sister, and I didn't have a lot of difficulties that I think some other folks may have had, as I think back on it. But I know that there were things about me that eventually accelerated that alcohol seemed to be a solution for, and of course it wasn't. But I started Druid Hills High School. I was active in sports. I was actually a very good student. I mean, I was kind of a pretty good kid. Had a girlfriend. Did, I guess you could say, what people might say would be, well, he's kind of doing what, kids do. But I remember when I was 14, we were going to have a camp out. And we all know how that goes. So we were going to get drunk and sleep on the ground. And I think our parents knew, everybody knew. And there was a Claremont liquor store, and you could go and you could kind of park around the corner, and there were these old guys that would be there, and I see some heads nodding, and, they would see the high school kids pull up, and they would flock to the car, and, you would give them a certain amount of money. They'd go in, and, they would make a recommendation. So we got, y'all know Mad Dog 2020 and Boone's Farm Apple Wine, and I think some Slow Gin or something like that. We were going to be sophisticated. So we go and camp out, which was really just all of us sitting around drinking. I got terribly sick, threw up, and couldn't wait the next day to do it again. And I became kind of a sensation. I'd fit in with the guys. And so I really, from the first time that I drank, I drank alcoholically. And I did like the way that it made me feel, in the sense that it did make me feel like I could fit in. And I wish I'd known now, you know, that I was not fitting in. I was masking a lot of issues that were just kind of below the surface. But I finished high school and had done well, and I was accepted University of Georgia. So at the time, because of the Vietnam War, the drinking age in Georgia was 18. So, you know, we guys at Claremont Liquor Store, you know, kind of lost a lot of customers. But I went up to Athens, and I mean, you can imagine, you're 18, and you know, you're away from home, and you're staying in a dorm, and you know, back then it's like you have these nickel a beer nights, and I was just loved every minute of it. But a pattern began to set in my life that lasted for quite some time. And that was, and I don't want to get in a term that is somewhat belabored, but in my case, I think there's some evidence that there was some truth to it. And that was that I was somewhat of what you'd call a functional alcoholic. And by that, I mean, I was able to keep my grades up. At that time, I did not drink at inappropriate times. I was able to get through the week. I would study. I went to class. But any chance that there was on the weekend, back then you had these keg parties, you know, I mean, I would just get hammered. And I even started noticing at that time when I was like 18, 19, 20, I was pretty much, and in Athens this was an accomplishment, but I was almost the town drunk of Athens, and that was saying a lot back then. I drank more than most of my peers. And I started to notice that, but not so much in a way that it concerned me, as much as just that I actually thought that it was something that was made me kind of a cool guy. But of course, unfortunately, I found out much later that it didn't. But that was a pattern that I established, that I was able to do the work that I had in front of me, and yet I was able to also carry on this life of drinking and drinking to excess every time I drank, and drinking more and more than the people around me were drinking. And the relationships that I had when I was with date girls was one where I think that I was not a good guy in that regard, because I think deep down I didn't have a lot of love or respect for myself. And so I had a tendency to treat anyone who I felt was crazy enough to be around me with less than the proper respect, because, you know, I thought, you know, if I'm looking in the mirror, what is it you're not seeing that I'm seeing? But that continued. So I finished my undergraduate degree. I did stick around, told my parents I wanted to stay in Athens, and I got a master's degree. And so I was ready to hit the corporate world, and I got a job with AT&T. And my background was finance. So one of the things that enabled me to do was, even though I was probably had the emotional maturity of, you know, the 14-year-old arrested development, you know, I was able to do, you know, things with numbers that, you know, you didn't necessarily have to have a lot of emotional IQ to, you know, you didn't do spreadsheets back then, but you did pro forma statements. But I was, so I got out, I did the same thing. I came to Atlanta, got an apartment, you know, and then I didn't have to worry about anything during the week. So, you know, I could go and drink every night at a bar. At the time, that was the people that I had gone to school with. We were all kind of in that time frame. You're in your 20s. You know, everybody smoking pot. That was when Coke was first coming out to be kind of more of a designer drug. And so, you know, I would do that, but not as a drug of choice. But, you know, I was certainly putting other substances in my body, but alcohol specifically, beer was what my go-to was. And I started noticing, though, that my friends were starting to do, I'd call it like adult things. So they were going to settle down. They were going to get a steady girlfriend, and they were going to get married. So I decided that I needed to get a steady girlfriend, get married, and then I would be an adult. So I did that. And the attraction was actually, and I have to admit, it was kind of one of these things. It was physical, and she was also a drinking buddy. And what better combination did I need at the time? So then, in order to continue trying to be an adult, we bought a house. And I still, would wake up every Saturday, start drinking. I could tell there was a little worry in her face, but not to the degree that she felt comfortable saying much about it. And then we were getting ready to move to New Jersey, which was AT&T headquarters at the time. And I started looking around, and a number of my friends, they were pregnant. They were going to have kids. So I remember I came home, and AT&T was going through the strike. So we were working 12 hours a day, 7 days a week. And I came home, and I said, hey, let's have a kid. And, and I'm very blessed. But it was just one more thing that I felt was going to make me what I conceived to be an adult. But I still behaved like the teenager that was drinking, Boone's Farm apple wine when I was 14. Time elapsed. We had a beautiful little girl, Katie, who I'm fortunate to be very close to today. And then that followed up with David Jr., who I'm also close with. And I said, I think now is the time that my alcoholic behavior started to become an issue. So we moved to New Jersey, and I had a good job, and we lived in a somewhat rural area of New Jersey because it was so expensive. And I remember that I had kind of crafted in my mind that there was this persona that I was going to kind of embody, right? So I was this, made sure that as soon as someone met me, they knew where I'd gone to college, what my degrees were, a few things like that that were going to deflect any discussion, but I was going to kind of build myself up in what I considered to be the kind of person that would be attractive to folks. And, of course, then I was also always had a can of Miller Lite in my hand, and so I had this idea that I was kind of this, like, really cool guy. I'd drive in the driveway, and I'd get out with a beer. The kids would kind of toddle out, and, but it wasn't like the Cleavers coming home. Ward was never blackout drunk when he was with the boys upstairs. But that became a habit, and so that's what I did every night pretty much. And I knew that it was causing some worry with my wife. There were some little hints that would be dropped, but I was able to deflect a lot of things. You know, you can't imagine how tired I am, how hard I'm working. You know, we all know how that kind of goes. And then I started coming into the point where other people were pointing out my drinking. Now, I'm not that old at this point. I'm like, I guess, 29, maybe 30. And there were these people that lived across the street from us, Mike and Cindy Wasilak, who I think they meant well. But I think we know how this kind of goes. We would walk across the street to visit with them. They had younger kids. We did. And Cindy was a pharmacist. And so Cindy was from New Jersey. She goes, Dave, you know, your liver's going to explode. And I thought, And so she says, I said, I don't know why you think that. And, she kind of looked at me like, well, what about last night? And so she started giving me this stuff like iron pills and milk thistle and all of this. And then I would see these whispered conversations between her and my wife, and it was clear that I was the topic of the conversation. Now, that never made me do anything except to be more careful. And I remember the Wasilaks had this refrigerator in their carport, and they always had beer in it, right? And so you know how this is. And one of the things, I remember a guy called me up when he asked me about, a guy I knew in Atlanta called me up when I first moved to New Jersey. He said, hey, how are you liking the job? And he thought I was going to say something about AT&T. I said, man, you're not going to believe this. I said, the bars all sell alcohol, and you can go in the bar. They open most of them at 6. There's one in downtown that opens at 6 a.m. And at 3 a.m., you can still get a packaged beer. And so there's only this little window of about 3 hours that you got to manage possibly not getting anything. So what I found out was after a while that in order for me, you know, to go to procure whatever day, like a Saturday or Sunday, well, you know, I needed, like, it was probably a 4 or 5 minute drive into town. So, you know, any time that would be like 1.5 Miller Lights. So I go over to Mike and Cindy's and kind of skulk over there, grab 4 or 5 beers out of their refrigerator. And I found out later that they knew it. And, you know, but I thought I was, and I'd stuff them in their pockets. And I'm a grown man doing this. Walk over. And so I started getting a lot of comments that I was, that there was a pack. And I remember one time my wife said, you know, you got to be careful. You know, you're holding Katie last night, and I thought you were going to drop her, some stuff like that. And so I said, well, you know, by God, I'll show you, and I'm not going to drink. And I think I had a birthday coming up, so I somehow or another didn't drink for like 3 days and punished everybody in the family for that. And the way that things kind of ended in New Jersey, and I wish that some of this had made a difference to me at the time, but it didn't. And one of the things that I liked to do was, you know, you had a lot of snow up there. And I had a four-wheel drive Tahoe. And I loved to go driving around in the snow. Well, I like to drive and drink. You know, I mean, some of you can understand that. And that was kind of something I enjoyed doing. And that's, I think it's pretty sick to say that, but it was true. And I remember I would take the kids, and they were like little. They were 2 and 4. And they were in their little car seats in the back, and their little feet are just sticking straight out. And so I would have my cooler Miller Lite beside me. And we would just drive around in the snowstorm and look at the snow, you know, and look at the snowman or what. And so we were driving around one day, and I'll never forget it to this day. And Katie, who's the oldest, said, you know, Dad, why do you drink so much beer? You know, out of the mouth of babes, right? And I said, oh, I don't know, you know, I like the taste. And my son, who's always kind of been my advocate, maybe not when he should have been, he goes, yeah, but Dad never gets drunk. So it's kind of interesting. Now, this is a 2-year-old and 4-year-old, and this didn't just pop into their heads. You know, this had been a topic of conversation at some point. And I said, well, you know how it is. You know, I just, you know, and of course, I've got a can of Miller Lite between my legs, and I'm driving around in a snowstorm with a 2-year-old and a 4-year-old. And I think sometimes, you know, I have friends who talk, and it's very poignant when they talk about for defects may have taken their children. And it is usually for the exact kind of behavior that I was exhibiting at that time. New Jersey had very strict laws. If I had been pulled over, it would have been automatic jail time, and it would have been very serious repercussions. And I did not suffer those types of repercussions. But what was starting to happen was that, you know, while I would have told anyone that I love my children more than anything in the world, even at that point, I love Miller Lite a little bit more. And I have to face up to that and be, you know, honest about it, because I did. So, but things continued to go well at work. So I was doing well, and I was promoted, and we moved to London. And so I made a name for myself in London Gatwick Airport, not the kind you'd want. And, you know, I would go and I would fly in a lot, and I would go back to the States, and we were living in Kensington, so kind of a nice area of London. And again, you know, everybody thinks about the Brits being big beer drinkers. Well, they looked at it more socially. I just wanted to get drunk. And quite often when I would be flying back to the United States and I'd be able to go on a weekend, I would be happy to sit in the bar. The first plane back to Washington Dulles might be, say, at, you know, noon, and the next one would be coming in at 6. And I was happy to sit in the bar until 6 instead of flying on back to Virginia. And they could pour me off the plane in Virginia, and I didn't have to face the family. They're back in London. And so then we moved back from London to Northern Virginia. And we lived there for the next 10 years with only kind of one little foray back into New Jersey in Florham Park. But by now, Alcohol was dominating every aspect of my life. I was either planning on how I was going to be drinking. I was drinking, of course. I was remorseful about having done what I'd done the night before. Things were starting to occur. I was very involved in my kids' sports. And my son was a pretty good little baseball player. And I remember a couple of times helping out. And, you know, a guy I knew as a coach came over and he said, "Oh, you know, you're throwing some pretty fast pitches there for the kids." And I said, "Yeah." And he said, "Well, you know, parents smell alcohol in your breath, you know." And so I'm looking over the stand, you know, fuck, you know, parent volunteer and all that kind of thing. And so I'm angry at the parents. You know, that was, I did not look at my behavior as being anything other than something that should be accepted. But I would continue to do well at work and be a train wreck in my personal life. The conversation started. We would be sitting in the driveway after going out. This would be my wife and I. By then, we would both go out. The only thing we had in common was drinking, but we would be talking about each other's drinking. We'd run through babysitters like you can't imagine, because we'd get kids in the neighborhood to come babysit, and the heads, that's my last name, were known. You know, you tell the kids you're going to be home at 10, and we'd be home at 1, and the parents would, you know, you wouldn't have a babysitter anymore after that. And we'd usually be sitting in the driveway arguing about my drinking, and then me accusing her of drinking too much, and then me accusing her of not understanding the enormous pressures I was under and what a tremendous provider I was to the family. And so I was looked at myself, as I do now, as an economic bully, because that's really what I was. You know, I could kind of, let's go to Disney World, you know, or, let's take a trip somewhere and, you know, why don't you go get a new car and please shut up and let me go back to sitting out in the driveway and drinking. So it got to be a pretty sick way of living my life. And that went on. And so it's getting kind of the time to talk about that there is some decent ending to the story. But what had happened by then, of course, we finally moved back here to Atlanta. And it was, you know, it's one of those things. The marriage was pretty much irretrievably broken. We moved in a neighborhood that there was a lot of pretentious sort of folks. I think I wanted to be, but I was too busy with just being a drunk to even do that. So of course, then we started talking about getting the divorce, and that starts to come. My daughter was getting ready to start Georgia, and my son was a sophomore in high school, and I remember one time. And it was, this is the point, guys, that it was like, every night, stagger in, drunk. I would, wait to come home till about 9 o'clock. And, it was evident that Dad was, you know, drunk, an alcoholic. And my wife would, all the begging and pleading had pretty much ended. Except for my kids would then start approaching me. You know, Dad, look what you're doing to us. I can never forget, that statement being made. And you would think, going back to 1993 and 1994, driving around when the kids are 2 and 4, why do you drink so much, Dad? And then now Katie's doesn't want me to go move her into Brumby because she doesn't want her father staggering around trying to carry stuff in the dorm. So, you know, 14 years have elapsed, and all that's happened is the disease has progressed. And that's what it does. And so what had happened with me was, I no longer really had any kind of moral compass. And I'd like to say, as I've looked at it now, that I was, I think I was morally and spiritually bankrupt. Now, I had been raised as a Methodist, you know, and I had, fortunately, that was something I think that saved me. I did not have an issue with God as my higher power, but I did not have a conscious contact with God. So finally, what happens, guys? The train wreck's about to end, so you can be glad of that. But I get divorced, as you could imagine. Daughter's at Georgia, not speaking to me. We, of course, had my son in all kinds of private schools and therapy and all of that kind of thing. I'm like, just, you know, just a drunk. I mean, that's just it. There's no other way to put it. So on February 2nd of 2006, I to this day am not sure quite what happened, but I must have fallen. I have no idea. But I was kind of dividing my time between a little place I had up at Lake Burton where I could go run away and a little place I had here. Somehow or another, I made it to North Fulton Hospital emergency room. Now, up until that time, I had stringently avoided any contact with blood being drawn, like for a physical, because I knew what the answer was going to be. But anyhow, they kind of poked around the emergency room, and I was thinking I'd, you know, broken my back. And they said, no, you haven't. But they said, yeah, you got a primary care physician. I said, yeah, I do. I said, maybe you ought to go see him tomorrow. And they're starting to spend an inordinate amount of time poking around right here, and that's where my liver was. And, you know, so I was scared, but not so scared that I hadn't planned ahead of time. So I had my Miller Lights to sustain me until I could go see the North Atlanta primary care the next day, which was February 3rd of 2006, which by the grace of God is the last, was my first sobriety date. First day, you know what I mean. February 2nd, last day I drank. February 3rd, 2006, that's, as of today, that's the last drink that I will ever have to take, I hope. But I went to my doctor. They said, we've got to do an ultrasound. They said, we look at the liver tests that were sent back. Your AST and ALT are at the point where we think that you have cirrhosis of the liver. And everything that had happened up in my life until then would have given you every indication that I didn't care if I lived or died. But this was God doing for me what I couldn't do for myself. And it was the gift of desperation because I was so afraid that I had cirrhosis of the liver. And I had some friends and connections, and I was able to get a liver biopsy actually scheduled for the next day. So I asked the folks there, and I had no idea what an AA meeting even was. But they gave me an address of 8111 Roswell Road. They said, why don't you go there? There might be some people here that could help you. And I thought, well, I'm at the doctor. You know, how if y'all can't help me, how can you know these people help me? Well, they did. So I showed up there about 4:30, 5:45 meeting, which is my home group. I sat down on the back porch, started asking everybody there if they had cirrhosis of the liver. Did they know what it was like? Did I look like I had it? You know, did they think that I was going to die? You know, and they were kind, you know, for the most part. Then the meeting started. I went and sat in the meeting, and I think I actually did think I could go sit up at the desk, and because I'd had people, you know, in my professional career that had to put up with me. Well, these people didn't put up with me, and they made it clear that I was not the center of attention, although in the regard I was, that they were going to help me get sober. So I have to tell you guys, I didn't really want to stop drinking. But this was God saving my life, and that is exactly what happened. So if I tell you what happened afterwards, I get the biopsy. They said, you don't have cirrhosis. And I mean, I was flooded with relief like y'all can't imagine. But they said, well, you know, you just don't drink. Because if you do, you know, it's going to be really bad. And it's not going to be fast, but it's going to be fatal, and you're going to die. And I think I grabbed onto that, like the chapter in the book about, you know, like a drowning man grabs onto a life preserver. And so what I believe, y'all, is that God gave me the most valuable tool set he could, which was the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was able to combine those two with what became a conscious contact with God, which I had not had before, and I developed that. And I began to enjoy the fellowship, and I began to look around to see a face that's just like here and see people that would become some of the closest friends that I've ever had in my life and who have never dropped me in times when I needed them. And so that was the message, and it's been a very good life. The things that I've done, I have tried to, I think, keep it pretty simple. I go to a lot of meetings, have a good sponsor. I've actually got a very, very good friend who is probably more of a sponsor to me than a sponsor, but I don't think he's officially accepted that title yet. But it's just been such a better way of life for me. And the thing that I would hope that would come away from this, if there is anything, is that the thing that's unique and special about me is that to myself, I'm unique and special, and every one of you is unique and special, every one of you. Every one of us is God's creatures, and we're here by the grace of God today, and we have a chance, and we have a solution. And that was what I always hope that people can see, is that I did not have some of the calamities take place in my life that I think many of you probably have. And I wouldn't even presume to know some of the difficulties that you've had. But by the grace of God, I'm standing here before you. I went through a difficult time with my brother. And I was sustained a great deal by the program during that time. And I'm very grateful that you asked me to be here today. I'm thankful that you gave me the time. And I say God bless each and every one of you, and I hope to be back someday. Thank you.
Thank you. That was really great.
On that broad highway.